From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LeBlanc. Our climates are changing, and you're not wrong if you suspect that these changes have been happening more rapidly over recent years. You're also not wrong if you ascribe these changes to the proliferation of carbon and other greenhouse gases in our atmosphere that has been happening since the Industrial Revolution. But there is this prevailing idea that before these industrialized centuries, the world was a largely natural place, mostly undisturbed by human action. And that's just not true. Through foresting and hunting and mining and burning and irrigating and city building, humans have been impacting regional and even global climates and ecologies for millennia. And Todd Bragey says that if we want to understand our many possible futures under a changing climate, we need to understand those parts of our past. Bragey is an anthropological archaeologist who specializes in long-term human-environmental interactions. He spent 15 years as a faculty member at San Diego State's Department of Anthropology and is now the executive director of the Museum of Natural and Cultural History at the University of Oregon. He's formally written books about the rise and fall of commercial abalone fishing in California, the ecological history of California's Channel Islands, and archaeology and marine conservation on one of those islands, San Miguel, and about human impacts on marine mammals in the Pacific. His newest book touches on all of those subjects and many more examples of the ways in which humans have changed the planet on which we live. It's called Understanding Imperiled Earth: How Archaeology and Human History Can Inform Our Planet's Future. Todd Bragey, welcome.
Thanks so much. I'm really delighted to be here, Matthew.
Todd, your career has been largely defined by the exploration of human settlement and cultures in and alongside the Pacific Ocean, but you grew up in a much different place in northwestern Indiana, and then you went to school to study anthropology just on the other side of Chicago in southern Wisconsin. What drew you to the Pacific?
So when I got out of undergraduate, I had an uncle that was living in Portland. And when I was a high school student, I'd go out and visit him. And it just, Portland felt like a completely different world. And one that, you know, was just fit for exploration and the trees and the oceans and the mountains, something that I just wasn't accustomed to growing up, and it felt a lot like paradise. And as soon as I got done with undergrad, I knew that I wanted to live in that world and head out west.
After a couple of years as a middle school teacher, you wound up in Tonga.
Yeah, I joined the Peace Corps, living in a community, trying to help in bringing the skills that I could. But I mean, the reality of doing Peace Corps work is the community you live with takes care of you while you're there for 2 years and away from your family. And that sort of experience really solidified my desire to be an anthropologist, to be an archaeologist, to be a student of culture.
Because in Tonga, you got this taste of the environmental challenges that we're facing, in particularly in our world, communities living on islands along the coastline.
I was there to teach in a program that was designed for sort of post-secondary students who are interested in becoming elementary school teachers. But then on the weekends, I would spend my time helping my host family on their local farm, riding my bike around the island, visiting archaeological sites, and just fell in love with the place and the environment. But in doing so, sort of understanding sort of the challenges that people face on these small islands in the Pacific where resources are limited and living with the land and with the ocean and striking a balance between human needs and natural systems becomes very critical.
You know, we often think of the risks that communities like this face are pretty new. Like rising seas resulting from climate warming are thought to be a big threat to island nations. Tonga's one of the most at-risk countries in the world for the hazards associated with rising seas, like cyclones and flooding. But human-caused risks to regional ecologies didn't start with global warming. Tonga's a pretty good example of this in several ways. And a lot of those problems have been rightfully attributed to European settlement, contact, colonialization. But one of the things that we can see on the Polynesian islands is that some of these islands have been populated for thousands of years, and then others never were. And so this is even pre-contact. And what do we know about the difference in the ecologies of these islands, the ones that were populated and the ones that were not? Or I should say, the ones that were successfully populated and the ones that were not.
Right. Well, what we know is it's complex, right? And it can't boil down to one thing or the other. You can't say, well, the local environment and the set of resources was the determining factor on whether people were successful or not. Nor can we say human choices are the sole determination of success or failure. But actually, it's a really complex mix of both. In some cases, ecologies, local ecologies, lack of soil formation, or the suite of resources that were available or not make it more challenging or less challenging, and vice versa, right? So one can weigh more heavily than the other, but it's never one or the other.
You have written, though, that like on islands without significant prehistoric occupation, there's not much evidence for things like bird extinctions, which were more common where humans landed and settled.
Yeah, absolutely. So we can see common themes, right? So part of the misconception, I think, that many people have, and this is where this idea that people of the past and indigenous peoples lived in complete harmony with nature, right? They were the natural conservationists, and they never had any impact on the world. And that's not to say that the impact of people in the past wasn't at a different scale than we see today with modern, industrialized, globalized communities. Certainly it was, right? It was more localized impacts. But people of the past and all people have an impact on their environment. They are not operating in a system that is natural. If people are there, it's this complex mix of a natural anthropogenic system. And so we need to understand those impacts. So at times, those impacts are negative, right? And we can see examples of bird extinctions in heavily populated islands across the Pacific and declines in biodiversity. But we also see people managing these ecosystems and adding biodiversity or managing resources in really effective ways. So it's never one or the other. We have to understand and appreciate all the ways that humans impact their environment, past and present.
And at a local level, these interactions might seem like small changes, like an extinction here and agricultural innovation there. But there's this analogy that is associated with meteorologist Ed Lorenz that helps explain why a small change in initial conditions can result in a large difference in a later state. This is this idea that, you know, a butterfly flapping its wings in one part of the world has the capacity to introduce the chaos that impacts weather patterns in a totally different part of the world. We call this the butterfly effect. I think people appreciate this, but for some reason, I suppose we don't always recognize that every species that we've hunted or polluted into extinction, or every fish gate that we have built, or, you know, every agricultural innovation that we bring from one place to another has the capacity to change global ecology in similarly trophic ways. And that has been happening for thousands and thousands of years.
And this is one of the challenges for getting folks to understand, and particularly scientists and resource managers, to understand the relevance of the past to sort of the modern, our modern moment and our modern environmental crisis. There's this idea that people in the past, their impacts were largely local or maybe regional. They weren't global. So it's not something we have to deal with. But in fact, I mean, the way archaeologists and people who study history think about this thing if we're talking about a global community of people having measurable impacts on their environment, whether it's local, whether it's regional, don't those add up to global impacts across Earth, across the globe, that are impacting entire planetary systems? And where we're at today is the result of cumulative human impacts that started millennia ago. It has to be our roadmap for moving forward.
This is such a challenge, though, right? Because one of the things that makes it hard to see these millennia-old impacts is that a lot of these changes are sort of camouflaged by the way we see the modern world. One example that you wrote about in your book that I connected with was Angkor Wat. I was in Cambodia with some students a few years ago, and we visited this temple complex, which is considered to be the largest religious structure in the world. And when I was there, I had this sense that these ancient builders, you know, they really knew how to create alongside nature. You point out something that also the French archaeologist and architect Christopher Poitier noticed about Angkor, which is that the people of Angkor actually changed pretty much everything about that landscape 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if you go back to some of these major civilizations around the world, like Angkor Wat, like the Cambodian Empire that spanned much of Southeast Asia, they were geoengineering entire landscapes, including building massive waterways and changing hydrological systems across massive areas and stretching these resources and farming aquaculture to the limit. And so when things like monsoon systems change, the sort of reliable natural systems that kept this hydrological engineering running, when that changed, they were pushing these systems to the limit, and those small natural changes caused the collapse of entire civilizations, right? That entire Angkor system in a geologic blink of the eye sort of collapsed.
Let's talk about another way that humans have changed the planet. That's deforestation. This, again, is something that we often associate with the past few hundred years as our population has exploded and lumber has been used to build. But you wrote about a project that was led by the geographer Neil Roberts on European forest cover over the past 10,000 years. The finding here, to me, was absolutely striking. This had to do with when forest cover was at its maximum. And I would have thought probably up till about 300 years ago. I would have been wrong, right?
Yeah, so if we look at Roberts takes, he does an analysis throughout all of continental Europe and looks at sort of pollen records up and down Europe for, you know, thousands of sites. And what he found was that forest cover in Europe really peaked at right before agriculturalists move into Europe, so starting about 8,000 years ago. And quickly, sort of hunter-gatherer communities are brought into these agricultural communities. People adopt this new way of life. And very quickly, we get a deforestation of native forests across Europe. And from that moment on, these European landscapes are never the same. There are periods where we see reforestation and then deforestation again. So it's not sort of a steady deforestation of Europe that happens stepwise through time. There's lots of noise in this. But we have to go back at least 8,000 years to look at those records. Not what you would think, right? The moment right before industrialization.
And these two things, agriculture and deforestation, are these two really major parts of the hypothesis proposed by William Rudman, who has suggested that farming and forest clearance actually may have kept our planet warmer than natural climatic cycles would have had. That would be human-caused climate warming, thousands of years before the Industrial Revolution. And so If Ruderman's correct, we might actually be riding something of a double wave of warming right now.
The Ruderman hypothesis is a really interesting one. And when it first was proposed, it was incredibly controversial, as you can imagine. But Ruderman, along with a group of climate scientists, sort of noticed through the study of ice cores that can trap basically atmospheric conditions in really fine detail. And his team noticed that starting about 8,000 years, the world should have been, if everything was operating along a sort of natural system, that the world should have still been cooling. And what he saw, in fact, is that the world was warming. And he was searching for these explanations. And this wasn't lost on other scientists and other geoscientists and climatologists, but they offered sort of more natural explanations for this, things like methane seeps and other sort of natural systems. But what Ruderman offered and suggested and was able to show with archaeological data that in fact it is and it was the deforestation of Europe and of Asia connected to the rise of agriculture and the spread of agricultural communities around Europe and the Old World that released all these carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases into the upper atmosphere that made the world warmer. It started this warming trend. And in fact, this was a really good thing at the time for human communities, right? It made agriculture a better way of doing business, right? It created a warmer world. It created better conditions for these early agricultural communities. So it's an example starting 8,000 years ago that links human systems, human decision-making, agriculture, and deforestation with the rise in greenhouse gases and the warming of the Earth.
There's this argument that people who oppose the idea of anthropogenic climate warming often say, which is that global climate is very big and very powerful and it's always changing. And so it's really unlikely that we puny humans are actually having any real impact. What your book suggests, what this research that you've been talking about suggests, is that humans have been changing the climate for 10,000 years, for thousands of years. It's actually not that hard. We did it with much smaller numbers, with much less technology, long before municipal power plants and internal combustion engines and industrial scale farming. So it shouldn't actually be all that hard to believe that as we approach 9 billion people on this planet, we could be having an impact.
Clearly, we need to get comfortable with this idea that people are global ecosystem engineers. The conversation we really need to be having is not whether humans are having an impact on these global systems, but what we should or should not be doing about it, right? I mean, that is the political conversation we can have, right? That the science really is undeniable. But the next conversation needs to be, okay, knowing all this, what do we want to do about it? And what the past tells me and what these records tell me is that, well, we can understand the scale of impact. We can calculate how much deforestation was happening in the past, what the impacts in terms of global temperature were, and then we can build plans for reforestation, for ways in which we can combat this acceleration in greenhouse gases and reverse course and fix these problems that we've created. We can't let these challenges that seem overwhelming prevent us from action. There are things that we can do, and there are ways that we can address these problems.
You started your career as a middle school teacher in Portland, Oregon. That only lasted a few years before you headed off to Tonga, but I'll bet you still feel connected to middle schoolers. These people of this age are such bellwethers. And right now, you know, surveys across the globe suggest that children and teenagers are devastatingly concerned and scared for their futures, even to the point that it's impacting their mental health. I'm wondering what you think a 10,000 year view of human impacts on the Earth would potentially do for people of that age, if it became a more common way to talk about what we are facing right now.
One of the reasons that I took the job I'm at now as the director of a natural history museum was sort of my passion for broader education, you know, and I really enjoyed my 15 years in academia and teaching college age students. But I saw, I've always had this passion for speaking not only to college age students, but lifelong learners and elementary and middle school students and people of all ages that are interested in natural and cultural history. And so, you know, for me, the need to teach people about sort of the deep history of humans and why deep history and archaeology in particular matters for future Earth is that because when we take this long view of the world, it can, I really do believe it can relieve and alleviate some of that strain and provide hope that things can change and we can make things better and that there's always something we can do. And one of the examples I like to give is when the telephone was invented, right? And people started to all have telephones available to them in their house. People were very concerned it was going to be the end of human social relationships, right? In-person social relationships, that people were going to have all their communication over the telephone. They're not going to need to get together and be social. And it was this technology or this moment that was very scary for folks, right? And we look back on that now and say, well, that was silly. That didn't replace anything. People adapt and change. And in fact, now we have new technologies that we have similar sort of worry and consternation over. But if we take the long view, we can sort of understand that people have been dealing with challenges for millennia. They've faced incredible odds to environmental challenges, social challenges, and have found ways to overcome. In some cases, we have examples where people fail and stumble and new solutions are built. Others, people find quickly positive solutions for their challenges, but things march on. For me, history and this long view of the world helps people think creatively about how to move forward. And in positive ways, we can find ways to work together to make the world a better place. And if we're going to vision that world, if we want to know what that world is going to look like, and if we're going to come to an agreement on the world we want to live in and how to create this biodiverse, sustainable, resilient world, it has to be the lessons from history that help guide that. Because we don't even know what's possible unless we look to the deep past. Like, how can we know what our options are? I try to tell folks, I want to be very clear, we're not going to go put the world back to what it once was. That's a fallacy. It's not possible to rewind the clock and put the world back to some idyllic past state. But what we're trying to do is find, well, what did the world once look like? And what do we want the desired future conditions to be? And how can we get there? And in many ways, I think the past is one of our really important guides.
That's Todd Bragey. He's an anthropological archaeologist who specializes in long-term human-environmental interactions and the executive director of the Museum of Natural and Cultural History at the University of Oregon. His new book is called Understanding Imperiled Earth, How Archaeology and Human History Can Inform Our Planet's Future. Todd Bragy, thank you.
Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure. It was great talking to you.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio. And if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University. And from listeners like you, you can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.